Hey, everybody. Welcome to Interview Month for The Perceptive Photographer. I'm your host, Daniel Gregory, and I am really excited today. We're joined by Sarah King, who's an amazing photographer and really talented artist. And I'm super excited to have a conversation with her about her art and kind of how that has transpired over her life and how she really pursues her creative acts. So one of the things I know about you is that you've got a very artistic background and it started in dance. What was it like to professionally work in that field and how did that actually come about that you got to be a dancer?
Well, as my parents tell me, when I was 2 years old, I marched up to them with my hands on my hips and put my little chin in the air and proclaimed that I was going to be a primo ballerina.
Wow.
Right. And they literally said that they put their hands up and sipped back and said, okay. So I think the draw to dance was there from when I was really tiny. And I don't know exactly why that was. I think I like to move. And that was sort of the easiest means of expression for me. So I was moving since the time I could walk. And then when I started classes, I just kind of kept going and going and going. Did end up leaving classical ballet and even modern in my early 20s, and I moved to Spain to study flamenco there. And that's what I ended up doing. To say that I had a lengthy professional dance career, I think is incorrect. I ended up in New York City dancing there a little bit, but never in the capacity that I had dreamed of. And eventually I came to the conclusion that I loved dance too much not to like it, and I had stopped enjoying it in a fundamental sense. So I stepped away.
Was that because of the pressure of trying to do it professionally versus just for the joy of it?
Yes. Also, because in the U.S. there aren't very many flamenco companies that can hire dancers seasonally and offer a steady means of being a flamenco performer. There are maybe two or three companies, and despite being here in the States, they're still very picky about using dancers that are from Spain.
Wow.
Only.
Interesting.
So a lot of the performing opportunities, at least in New York City, for flamenco dancers and musicians were pickup gigs left and right. I felt like I hadn't trained for as many years as I did to dance in venues that were not satisfying to me.
Was that transition out hard?
Yes. Yeah, it was hard. Simultaneous to the decision to leave dance was my decision to go back to school. I had gone to Cornish here in Seattle as a dance major in the early and mid-90s and had quit the dance program in order to live overseas. And so found myself later in my, how old was I when I was living in New York? I don't remember, I can't think right now. Part of the decision to leave dance when I was living in New York was that I wanted to go back and get a degree, a bachelor's of arts degree, and thought that I could do that and continue to dance, but that wasn't realistic on a lot of levels. It was not possible to physically maintain the strength and endurance required to dance professionally from an injury prevention standpoint. So lack of time and energy to keep doing that. And there was an absolute identity crisis, and I did not expect that. But I was a wreck for quite a long time because I felt like I didn't know how to define myself anymore.
Wow.
Yeah.
I can see that though. I mean, from the earliest memories of being a dancer, where that's kind of like all you knew was
it's that. All I knew, and it's all I ever considered myself to be. There was never any, oh, I think I'll be a dancer. I always felt like a dancer, and I never had to question that within myself.
So,
but the day I stopped, then it was a little bit of a rude awakening.
And so if I understand the timeline right, in that identity crisis, that led you to then studying late medieval and early modern Iberian literature and culture. Was that inspired from your time in Spain? Is that where the love came from?
Absolutely. Yeah. I was already interested in it prior to moving to Spain. because of the historical context of flamenco and how that art form came to be. And then once I was living in Spain, I fell in love with the language and really, really fell in love with it passionately. I didn't speak any Spanish when I went. And month five, I remember specifically getting up and just started speaking the language. And it was really quite an experience for me to have that sort of shift happen, black and white. But yes, so back to your question, definitely living there, gaining a respect for the multiple cultures that are there and have been historically, and wanting to have a deeper understanding of all the varying contexts having to do with flamenco, mm-hmm. ultimately.
Then, so what ultimately caused you to pick up a camera then?
I don't have a super black and white answer for that. I can tell you that when I was studying at Columbia, so I was on the Columbia University campus at the time when Obama was sworn in for his first term. And they had huge projection screens in front of the library and, you know, just hordes and hordes of students. And I just remember the calm. Mm-hmm. I'm getting goosebumps just thinking of it. And I remember looking around and really for the first time going, oh, my God, I wish I had a camera. I want to document this. That went through my head. It's like I didn't allow myself to think about that anymore because I had already danced. And there I was in the middle of this difficult, academically very difficult situation that I put myself into. And there was an excellent photography instructor at Columbia. And I actually had signed up to take his class. Ended up breaking my collarbone while mountain biking and so couldn't take his class. And so never revisited the idea of taking photography as an elective. And then when we moved over here and I had decided not to pursue graduate work, I found a workshop online at the Flight Museum here in Seattle. And I went and it was fun. I was for some reason interested in it. And I came home and I said to my husband, Austin, hey, yeah, maybe photography could be a new hobby. And he paused and he looked at me and he said, why does it have to be a hobby? And that was a major aha moment for me.
Wow.
I went, it was a big moment for me because I hadn't considered the fact that I could pursue the arts in a different medium. It just hadn't occurred to me. So I think that was the shift for me. And then I went to the photo center and still take classes there.
Well, that's an amazing, I think, insight from Austin to really understand how important the arts had always been to you.
Right.
And then also your own blind eye, for lack of a better word, but your own blinders to why couldn't that be a new way to fulfill that? You know, I think that's one of the great things about our partners sometimes is they, in many ways, state the obvious.
They do. And I wouldn't be doing what I am today had I not. If he weren't my partner, he's beyond supportive. So
yeah, that is one of the consistencies I've learned over the years is that support is so important for all artists and all creative people to
definitely
have that safety net. So you're coming out of a dance background, you're coming out of a literature cultural study. Does that in some way, do you think, influence the way you approach your photography?
It must. It has to. I think certainly dance has influenced what I photograph and how I photograph. As you know, a lot of my first foray in analog film was photographing the woods, because that's one of the things that I feel most profoundly attached to in this world. And I noticed right away that what I saw in my frame, what I see in my frame when I'm in the woods is somehow analogous to my body's physical memory of certain aesthetics.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
I don't know if that makes sense.
That makes total sense. I mean, that's the minor white concept of an equivalent. You know, where a disparate object takes on the form of something else to invoke connection and memory and meaning.
Yeah, it definitely does do that for me. And it's not, you know, I've had people say, so are you trying to make a series where the trees look like dancers? And I say, no. That's not what I mean. And that's not what my goal is. It's literally an energy in the gesture of the trees that makes that connection for me.
Yeah, I think there's a sophistication to the artist who's looking at a subtext or a sublime mm-hmm. element to the work. And so mm-hmm. it's not trite, I think, on some level to go out and be like, oh, this is a tree that happens to be in a specific dance pose.
Right.
It's another thing to go photograph the emotion, energy, and context of the experience of dancing as found in nature. Mm-hmm. It just happens at this point to manifest itself in a tree, and the next day it could be in a rock, the next day it could be in a cloud. But that to operate at that level is a sophistication that's, I think, makes the art more interesting in the long run.
It does. And I don't have quite that connection with all subjects. When I'm photographing interiors and spaces, I think the connection back to dance is I frequently want to be low to the ground. I think that with all the dance training, you really learn specifically how to work with your weight and shifting your weight. And what those shifts can afford you physically in a space. But I think that has worked its way to me as a photographer in how can that, what perspectives can that, those shifts physically in my body, those changes, what kind of changes can that offer me? So I often find myself like, I just want to get on the ground. I just want to get low. And I think that might be connected back to dance somehow.
It's a great observation of your own working style and how that manifests itself. Because I think there might be a tendency for a lot of us to ignore that feeling for whatever reason we come up with. Compositional rules, what's normal, floors are dirty, whatever. So, I mean, I think the willingness to get past that.
Things can be more interesting if you're up at the ceiling or down on the ground.
So what do you love about photography?
I think one of the things I love about it is the challenge I have that all photographers have of seeing something that for some reason strikes you as beautiful or intriguing or interesting and wanting to capture that into an isolated moment and then eventually into a print. And then the challenge of actually doing that and being able to convey through one frame whatever it is that you're experiencing in the first place that makes you want to take that picture. Mm-hmm. So I think I've always liked challenges. I've presented myself with multiple challenges in my life, and I think that's one of them. I also think I really like it because I am still trying to make art, but it's very, very different. It's a very different experience for me than dance. With dance, you're so literally exposed. And there's a vulnerability for any artist, right? But I feel like the final product for somebody who is not physically up front and center being received by the public, I feel that's more difficult for me. And so I think I enjoy photography because I can step away from that. I can take my pictures. I can edit them. I can consider them. I can print them, present them where I want. And I don't have to be my physical self and my soul within that physical self doesn't have to be on the front line. I think that's one of the reasons why I like it.
Yeah, I think that's interesting as you were saying that. I think it made me realize that I think one of the criteria I've always tried to find to judge the effectiveness of a photograph is in that, you know, interpretation, does it describe meaning? We look at all those kind of classic things. But that I love that idea of the vulnerability of that dancer being up there raw and unprotected on some level. And I just wonder, like, for the photographs that are truly significant, I wonder if that is somehow actually in the photograph. And so, yes, while as the photographer, we might be protected, that we don't have to be in the room. But I just wonder in that, like, if that's when we create a great photograph, if
yes.
that's if on some level, we know, like, oh man, this is really me exposed. And then I get the benefit of I can go hide in the back room, but it's still on there. I've never thought about that interpretation. I think it's a great thing for me to think about going forward of a way to look at work and other mm-hmm. people's work and ask them, like, where is that sitting in that mm-hmm. in that space? It's one of the things that when I viewed Lori earlier in the month that she talked about, that there's a rawness to work that mm-hmm. it starts to get real when it gets raw. And raw yeah. creates a lot of emotional.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Issues or tenderness and concern and a bunch of mm-hmm. stuff comes up with that. But yeah,
I completely agree with that. And it takes many, 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 many years to be able to achieve that in whatever medium you're working in. And maybe I've done that in photographs that I can count on one hand. Maybe. Yeah.
So who influences your photography?
Who directly influences? I don't know if I have a very good answer for that. I can tell you who's been inspirational to me.
Right. Who's inspirational?
Well, Genevieve Lisa Barnes was hugely and continues to be hugely influential on my work, especially in the woods, which ironically, I've been talking to you a lot about that, but I haven't taken my camera into the woods for a very long time now. So definitely Genevieve, I think because of her, she seems to have a similar, almost spiritual connection with her subject, with nature, that I feel that I do as well. Eleanor Carucci. Mm. is a photographer that I was looking at earlier on when I was at a challenging juncture between being a new mother of a fairly young child and having decided not to pursue graduate work and not dancing anymore and being pretty interested in photography. I was introduced to her work at pretty key point and looked at her work and saw, oh, wow, this is possible to be giving most of yourself to your family and your child and pursue another art at the same time, and especially photography. Her photography is about her family and much of it of her children. And so that helped me give myself permission to understand that there was a validity in exploring motherhood and my own child and other people's children and the dynamic within the family and the space of the home. I think that helped me cross that hurdle. Her work did, I should say specifically.
It's great to be able to find that inspiration or influence at a time when you actually need it so that yeah. you can actually be receptive to it versus just,
right.
Well, these are kind of pretty pictures, but like, wow, there's a real connection there to, like you said, how to actually live a life and stay engaged. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
How do you know when you've taken a good photograph? You mentioned that you've got like 5, 6 where you've really had that strong connection. How do you know when you've made or created or framed or whatever words you want to put there, a good photograph?
5 might be an exaggeration, to be honest. It might be fewer, but that's not the point of your question right now.
yeah, we can debate how many we all have later. We'll get a few beers. We'll all agree we have none.
Exactly.
Or even not in your own, but when you look at another photograph, how do you know it's a good photograph, even if it's not in your own?
I think if something shifts in me that is all at the same time, psychological, physical, emotional, all within one package, if that happens as soon as I look at an image, or, you know, a few seconds down the line or something, I think that makes a great photograph. And I know that that is totally subjective, because that experience is, may not be there for everybody who looks at the same photograph. I also think that as my eye is maturing about looking at images and understanding what makes a more sophisticated image and the intention behind it, I feel like I'm starting to gain a better appreciation for something that maybe I would have seen before I started taking pictures and not understood it and gone, oh, that's just a picture of a fallen over tree in a vacant lot with a deflated balloon next to it. And I would have gone, oh, okay. But now I think I have the skills to appreciate it on a different level. So I think if I see a seemingly simple subject matter, does this make any sense?
No, it makes total sense. I think that's the, that's one of the things that I think, especially as we moved, we're this mass engine that we create, you know, billions of photographs that are shared and seen every day. There is something about, I love the way you said, as your eye is being more trained and being more sophisticated, as you're getting exposed to more and more photography, and what makes it significant allows you to differentiate what is, you know, in Bart's world, what is studium photographs? What are just, they pass by, they make no material impact, fine, they move on, versus the photographs of punctum that actually do create that attunement shift within our existence. But you have to train that. Like any skill, you have to learn to see photographs. And it doesn't mean that the deflated balloon and tree in the parking lot, like you said, somebody else looks at that and goes, eh, it's still just a balloon and a tree. But if you start to understand behind that, the concept behind that, what the photographer was intending to do, there is an appreciation, I think, that comes from that. I think you're right. You have to learn that by immersing yourself in the work. You just don't all of a sudden wake up one day and be like, oh, I'm a master of 20th century photography.
Right. Definitely. The more I learn and understand, the more you realize that you're not anywhere near where you want to be.
Well, we hope. I mean, I think there's some of us who are like, oh, I've made it to the third grade. I'm done. I'm out. So in looking at your work, and even if we, you know, take the trees in the forest, but in your more recent work, which we want to talk about a little bit more in depth, one of the things that always is present to me in your work is your sense of space, place, and people's relationship to that. Whether it's our position as the viewer or how people relate within the space that's being photographed. How do you think photography allows you to be pretty expressive in that sense of space, place, and relationship? What is it about that medium that does that? And while you're pondering, the reason I ask that is photography is such a medium of time, is one of the elements we always talk about in the compression and extension of time. But it's also about what's contained within that frame. And that frame is so important to you and what you include and exclude. Just how does that approach come for you? How is that, the medium support that for you?
I remember reading this, Daniel, and thought, oh, that's the hardest one.
That's why we put it in the middle. We don't start off with the hardest one.
Well, I really don't know if I have a good answer for that. Can you rephrase it?
I can. just in your work, like I said, the thing I've noticed is such a intentional creation of the environment and the space that's there.
Creation of the environment as in...
How you create...
Manipulated or...
No, as you observe it.
Okay.
So as you observe the space and then you choose what to frame. I've always... And one of the things I've always admired about your work is you have such a great sense of how to create and frame the space that you're photographing. You know, how do you think being behind the camera and the experience as a photographer allows you to create those spaces where you... Whether you're photographing a room or photographing in the forest, the way you... align things, position things, feels like it has such intention and respect for the space.
It does have such compositional intention that it kind of drives me crazy sometimes, because there's literally I get behind the viewfinder, and I'm a 50 millimeter person. We can get to why that is later. But there's literally, and I think that my background in dance makes me hyper attuned to what's happening to me physiologically. But when I see a scene through a viewfinder, it's uncomfortable, 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 uncomfortable. And then it shifts into the right spot and everything just calms down for me. So I guess that's what happens to me compositionally with my eye. But I don't think that's the question you're asking me.
No, I think even if that's not the question I'm asking, that's a really good answer. I think one of the things that your answer, I think, gets at the heart of what I was trying to ask, which is, I think one of the biggest challenges in photography is framing, because unlike painters, we don't get to compose. We get some level of control, right. But if we're not going to composite or go manipulate what's in front of us, we don't get to control necessarily how the room's set up, but we do get to control what we frame and choose to include and exclude. And I love what you said about when the room's lines and composition gets aligned, you physically feel that alignment within you. And that's when you know to take the picture. And I think that's why, to me, it answers that question of how is that sense of time and space coming together, is the lines intersect and align when your own physical response gets aligned. And that's how you know when to put it. I mean, that would be the question of how do you know when to push the shutter?
Mm-hmm.
Your attunement is aligned so that it doesn't feel like you're misweighted in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it is and I think that's the thing for a lot of photographers, if they don't get to that point, they struggle with, they understand the rules of composition, they understand the guidelines, they understand those principles, but if you can't get the awareness of it physically,
when that shift happens for you.
Yeah, you're going to ultimately miss the opportunity. I mean, that's the, Cartier Bresson always, they talk about the decisive moment, and that moment of, when everything comes together. Well, Cartier constructed the intersections of the lines and then waited for the event to happen. But he still constructed all the elements of the scene so that moment could unfold within that scene. And the only way he knew that was looking through the viewfinder and being like, oh, that's...
There it is.
There it is. And now I wait.
Yeah.
And then the person comes through on the bike, or the woman runs up the stairs, or whatever the gesture was that came into play. So no, I think that makes total sense for that.
And I think going back to the time piece in a little bit different way, I mean, spaces can exude a different mood and energy within 5-10 seconds, right?
Absolutely.
Even if there are no people or animals in the frame, even with you're dealing with just objects, or just trees, not that trees are ever just trees, but the energy in a space can change. And so choosing when you're going to take the picture is going to provide different content, I think, for your image. And also keeping in mind what you want to convey. For example, I was... photographing somebody's home a few months ago, and the first day I went in, they have a beautiful home, and it's often very well put together, and I photographed it, and that was great. And then on my way out, I said, well, I'll be back tomorrow. After the kids come home from school today and they play and rip the place apart, can you leave it? Because I want to come back in and capture that aspect of the space, because that tells a very, very different story. And having the two complement each other will be a more comprehensive narrative. So I think that's one of the sort of the links in the people's relationship to a space and a place. And then the time component is the actual shift.
Yeah, which sort of brings us into your main, I don't know if it's your main project, but I believe it to be one of your main...
It's my main business endeavor.
Main business endeavor. But I also think it's one of your main projects in terms of a shift in your approach to your photography, and that'd be your Vism monographs.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you tell everybody a little bit of what that is and how that came about?
Sure. So Visit Monographs is a unique service that I have been developing over the maybe last two, well, longer than that, but more formally in the last 2 years, in creating visual memoirs for people. And it's something that I started to think about 4 or 5 years ago. I took Zach Bent's Close to Home class at the Photo Center, and I had the desire to create an alternative means to the idea of a family photo album. And at that time, I had been working with two families that would just let me come in on a Saturday morning or whenever and photograph their family for 2 hours or so. And none of it was staged, none of it was, you know, these were wild and crazy families and a lot of fun to photograph. And had some great images come from that. But also, I remember that I was so intrigued, sometimes more, not by the people in the space, but by the space itself. And really becoming distracted, thinking, oh, but just look at that little funny object over in the corner, and it's so indicative of XYZ. So that was sort of happening simultaneously, this realization that I'm so intrigued by people's spaces. And then it formalized. I lost somebody very close to me about 2 years ago, and ended up photographing the home that they had lived in, printed out that proof set, got it up on my wall in my studio, and stepped back. And even though it was a heart-wrenching project to do because of the personal connection to it, I stepped back and I said, oh my God, this is what I've been working on. I thought, this is it, you know. And I went in.
It's such a great realization to have that feeling.
It was awesome. It took something really horrible and traumatic to happen to create that shift for me. But I just stepped back and I thought, this is a really beautiful memoir. And I even remember photographing the space and thinking, yes, I know this, that, and the other about their lives. But it was the ability for me to reacquaint myself with their lives also that was such a powerful process. And so then showed it to my husband. He really liked the work. And I said, you know, I want to do this for other people. And at first he said, not everybody's going to have such an interesting personal space or something like that. And I was like, that's not even the point. This is something that I want to be able to give to other people. So I started to pursue that and build a portfolio around creating visual memoirs for individuals and families. And it's catching on. And so now I'm in the process of getting my ducks in order business-wise. And that's a lot of fun too. And it's actually, I was offered my first show, my first solo show.
Congratulations.
Thank you, Daniel.
Very exciting.
Windermere Mount Baker, right around the corner from my house. They have a woman there named Susan Cole, who is a photographer herself, a fine art photographer, has a studio in down at Inscape Art Studios.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And she's an agent there, and she was hired specifically to act as a liaison to the local arts community.
Oh, that's very cool.
And so one of the things that office has decided to do is seek out artists that they want to host. I didn't see it coming. I didn't even know it was a possibility. And I walked in there 2 weeks to talk to her about VISM in a more general sense. She took a look at the work and said, we'd like to host you.
Well, it's wonderful.
So, yeah, I'm
very
excited
exciting.
About that.
And now the anxiety of creating the show comes into play.
It does, because at first it was April, but now there's a tiny bit of idea that it could be March. So
you have a busy February. Either way.
I do.
I think one of the things that's interesting about that project is when we oftentimes think about working on a family memoir or family portraits, there's some level of collaboration between individuals and the photographer. And in this case, you have a little bit of that, but your collaboration, like you said, is with that weird thing in the corner, and it's the space and all of that. What's it like to collaborate with the space? because we've talked a little bit about this, like, no matter how boring you think your life is, your house is actually full of interesting knickknacks that are things that are a reflection of who you are. And to go in and find what is unique and interesting, you can do that if you understand what the space tells you. So what's that collaboration like?
Part of it for me is walking into, for example, somebody's living room and having the challenge of trying to make some judgment calls about hierarchies of importance and value, not material, you know, not monetary value. Yeah. And everything is a clue, right? And so if you're sort of very in tune and you consider everything as an option, there are clues everywhere that if you can extract them, can reveal the essence of somebody's life. But the ability to go in and collaborate with the space in the sense of, okay, I'm going to look around and see what is most prominently displayed. Or maybe that little artifact is right next to the chair, their comfy chair. So it's a little bit of interpreting
Gotcha.
Why people have set their space up the way they have. And I'm sure I'm not always correct. And I always have to talk to the people and they, you know, give me a tour and talk to me about things. So that's the first. And also, I don't underestimate little moments.
Gotcha.
It could be that a dusty stack of books that is shoved carelessly under the child's dresser is the thing to be photographed and will be the most sentimental thing. Whereas if I were photographing for Architectural Digest, that would have to be cleared out with a quickness, and yeah. You would just never do that. So it's the more poignant, back to the raw moments,
Yeah. Even
though we're not talking about people, we're still talking about spaces. Those are the ones. So that's collaborative for me too. It's kind of like going and having a conversation. It's like, okay, reveal yourself, reveal yourself. And there's a lot of giggling to be had on my part, you know.
Well, I love that.
To find little moments.
You said a clue, like you're finding these little clues to put together, and it
Yeah. Makes
me kind of think about if it's, you know, 100,000 years in the future and aliens show up and we're all off the planet and they've got to be like, so what do you think this thing was for? And like to try to figure out why every house had one of these. It must be important. Like, mm-hmm. But
yeah,
you know, find that out. And then the other piece I love about that, you know, for the person you're photographing the place for, dusty books underneath there. Like that is probably something for them that has become so everyday that it's never noticed. But like you said, is actually Mm-hmm. The quintessential experience of that child's room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's got to be really kind of a cool element to find then as you come back and share the work with people.
It is, because I think people are often surprised by what is going to be the most touching for them.
Yeah.
And that goes back to my conversation with Austin. I said, I want to do this for other people.
Yeah.
Because it not only is a wonderful keepsake, but I hope without being self-aggrandizing at all, I don't mean to be that way, but my hope is to afford people a process where they can sit down with their memoir, with their book object, and look through and revisit their lives and the lives of their kids. I think our image consumption today is so frenetic.
Yeah.
That enjoying any moment is really difficult.
Yeah. Getting somebody present to their own life is a huge gift, no matter how we get to it.
Put much more concisely than what I was saying.
I get the benefit of thinking about what you're saying. You have to think of it on the fly.
Yeah.
There is so much to learn about photography. And there's so much technical goo out there, and there's always a new camera, there's a new filter, there's a new this, and then you still do analog film and scan, and so you've got that whole piece around there. What keeps you from getting focused? What keeps you from getting distracted and allows you to focus on the photography and not be like, oh, look at me today, I'm doing 50,000 things of 3D Photoshop, which you may or may not ever use. How do you kind of keep yourself focused given all the noise of the technical?
I feel really fortunate that it's not a distraction for me. It's not a distraction I have to try to overcome. And there are a few reasons for that. One of them being money. I don't have the option of going out and buying the next best high-tech lens or even software. And also, I'm not drawn to it, and I don't know if I can say exactly why. It's interesting that you asked me that. I said earlier that I was a 50 millimeter person, and just yesterday I was thinking, you know what? I need to be sure to use a different lens because my eye is so fixed composing within that 50 millimeter space that it's like, if I don't really perk things up, you know, I don't want to plateau out.
Yeah.
So I just don't think that I just don't have the draw to the gear, and I don't know if I know exactly why.
No, I think that's great. I think the sin is usually to the other side. People spend more time on perfecting the gear than they do perfecting the craft.
Yeah.
And so then they end up where, like you said, the awareness to be attuned to books under the desk, a tree in the forest, that is not solved by any camera. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways what other people might see as a constraint actually in a lot of ways might actually be a huge benefit for you because you don't have to stand there in front of your bag and be like, I've got 37 lenses, you know, which is where I want. And I mean, when you said the 50 millimeter, I had the great privilege of getting to photograph with William Albert Allard, Bill Allard, a couple of years ago. Bill shoots a Leica with a fixed lens. That's what he shoots. And then he has this other little backup camera he carries. But we were talking about how he never crops. He's like, you just see it and you compose and you frame and then you don't ever have to worry about cropping if you just get it, you know, that right in the camera thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, what if you're back here? We were at a bar in New Orleans. And I'm like, well, what if I want to get just the, you know, the bassist in the back? Like I couldn't physically get back there to get the frame I want, but with a zoom lens or I could crop. He's like, why are you even looking at that? You don't have a lens that does that. He's like, you have a 35 millimeter lens. The world is 35 millimeter. And he's like, and if you put a 75 millimeter on, guess what? The world said, why are you thinking about that? I'm like, there is something about when you really intimately know your equipment that the world becomes, like you said, I love that. The world's 50 millimeter to me. That's what it is. And there's no other way to see it. And so if you get a different lens on, you'd be like, oh, this is a little claustrophobic or well, it's a little wide. Mm-hmm. But yeah, because that is your world in the power that would come from that. When you walk into a room, you know what you're going to see, you know how you're going to see it. I think that's really cool to have that.
It does feel good. It does feel a little bit restricting at times, but also sometimes I do bring my camera up to my eye with my 50 millimeter and I go, oh crap, I'm not seeing this in 50 millimeter and I've got my 50 millimeter lens. I also think that I know that the gear isn't going to make me a better photographer.
Yeah. Yeah, that should just be on every photographer's camera bag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Until I have an intentional reason to use a wide set of lenses, I probably just won't have.
Yeah.
I have my 50 millimeter. And then I rent a 24-70 zoom.
Yeah. Probably much more economical way to go.
Yes.
Of all your personality traits, good and bad, which do you think help your creativity the most?
Which do I think help my creativity? I like to challenge myself.
Okay.
I like a challenge, and I think that that's important when you're pursuing something creative because making good creative work requires time and experience and effort. And if I'm not constantly expecting more of myself, then I would never get anything done. Mm-hmm.
Which personality trait do you think is a hindrance?
Maybe the perfectionism and the desire to, I don't know how to say this. lack of patience, maybe. And I'm getting better. I'm getting better at that. And I remember, actually, Daniel, you said something to me a few years ago at the Long Shot exhibit. You'd asked me, well, how many years did you dance? And I said 20-something. And you said, well, how many years did you dance before you stepped on stage professionally? And I said, well, 20-something. And you kind of gave me this look like, so why are you expecting degree of expertise to come in any less time in reference to photography? And you're absolutely right. So I've become more patient with myself. But I do think that can be a hindrance. And wanting something to be really good before anybody sees it.
Yeah.
I'm getting over that though too.
Yeah, no, that to me is a tough one, because you always want to put your best foot forward, but on some level you need another set of eyes sometimes to help you see what you're either seeing as a strength or an area for improvement. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to find those trusted colleagues where you can be like, okay, look, I need some eyes on this, but I don't need you to be weird about it. I need you to put some eyes on it. And it's hard to find good people to do that, because it is important and yet scary, because it's like, it's not done and you don't want to make excuses, but at the same time, I need some help. And that's a tough one.
You know, it's interesting you brought that up, because I feel like I have finally just found that about in the past year. After a class I took last spring, to all the other students that were in the class, I said, if anybody wants to continue, every other week, same time, same place, as a critique group, let's do it. And five or six of us have stuck together for almost a year now, and it's amazing. It's really amazing, because each of us not only comes in either ready to show or give critique, it is such a trusted space.
Yeah.
And the stuff that I've brought to them and showed them and talked to them about, I don't feel comfortable doing that with anybody else, and they're nothing but supportive. I think that I hope the experience has been the same for each one of them, but it's a very special group.
I would say, without asking, the fact that they're still coming back would probably say
you're doing the right thing.
Yeah. Sadistic people will come back who weren't getting it, but artists don't come back and be like, oh, please torture me with no more helpful information. Yeah. So I think what you've got is definitely a neat, great group to continue to work with.
And a couple of them are thesis students this year. So
that's kind of interesting.
That's extra exciting.
They're getting a little extra feedback. Where everybody's pulling them a different direction now. So creative living seems to be an important aspect of your entire family. You've got massive creativity in your family. Why do you think that is? Do you think that is just the draw of creative people together, or?
I do think it's the draw of creative people together, and how those people became creative in the first place can vary. I was raised in a very creative home, and with two parents that were really very encouraging to both my brother and I to experiment and follow our own paths and our own minds in every which direction. My mother is a creative force to be reckoned with. She is she's amazing, and I'm sure that witnessing her creative mind go all these years through my childhood and now as an adult, I know has ingrained in me, well, of course, there's no other way to live other than creatively.
Yeah.
Austin's an architect, very creative himself. And so now with our son, who's 7, I think it's sort of natural for us to not only try to pass that off to him and encourage him to take this similar pathways. Mm-hmm. But I think also living creatively, for us at least, has to do with being interested and willing in finding alternative ways to do things that are outside of the norm or non-traditional or problem solving. We're doing something a little bit different with school right now. And I think it has a little bit to do or a lot to do with making sure that living creatively and keeping that space alive within his head, I mean, that's so important to us. You know, he and Austin will sit down in a weekend and, you know, build that foam core structure behind you. He and I make cyanotypes together. He wanted to learn about the digestive system. So we made a life-size diagram, and then we went into the yard and we decided which areas of the yard were going to be.
Oh, very cool.
The stomach and the small intestine and the liver and the large intestine. And he sprinted around tracing the digestive path through the different areas forward and backwards, and we timed it. And so living creatively also is, you have to figure out how to satisfy everybody in your family and make sure that,
No, that's great. That's, I'm never going to run through the yard the same way again.
No, you will not. Okay. You'll think about what you ate every time you do.
All right. I have a couple, and I'm learning that what I believe to be were the simple questions here at the end actually seem to cause the most angst. So, but there's just a couple, but just like, what's your favorite film, favorite movie?
Chariots of Fire.
Favorite TV show?
I don't watch TV. Right. No, I'll think about it. Netflix, that counts these
Netflix
days,
Netflix counts
right?
these days, yeah.
I'll have to come back to that. All right.
Favorite food?
Anything pickled.
Anything pickled, wow. Favorite way to spend a Saturday?
I want to say taking pictures.
Yeah, but...
Taking pictures, and a favorite way to spend a Saturday for me, I think I'm hearing that more as what would be an ideal Saturday for some reason. I'm going to reinterpret your question.
That's fine.
Ideal way to spend a Saturday would be to spend it with friends and family, and maybe photographing, maybe not, but just experiencing the desire to shift down and relax and not be caught up with, wait a minute, I should be doing this. Or no, I'm just going to go take an hour. I need to go take care of this one thing. So I think my ideal Saturday is being able to step out of this constant desire of productivity.
Gotcha. No, that makes total sense. And then favorite author.
Favorite author. Lorca.
Lorca?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, nice.
Mm-hmm.
And then last one, which you may have already answered, but I'll just, in the interest of closure, favorite photographer.
My absolute favorite photographer.
Absolute's a really big word. So just one that doesn't piss you off. I don't know. Just
Minor White doesn't piss me off.
Okay.
And Minor White is one of those people who I probably would have looked at 10 years ago, and some of his images I might have gone, what? I don't get it. And now I do.
Yeah.
And Paul Caponegro.
Yeah. Yeah, both those are... Yeah, if you're at all into the spiritual side of your existence and translating that into a photograph, those are two pretty good photographers to look at.
Tina Modotti also, I really like.
She was the better half of the Edward Weston world, yeah. Yeah, like those are the ones I think the best part of learning about Edward is you're like, wait, Tina was hanging out with Edward? Why haven't I seen her before? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Imogen Cunningham was another one of those for me. Like, wow.
Absolutely. She's of great inspiration to me too, because she was a mother, two twins, and working in and out of the dark room.
Yeah. Oh, and
with two toddlers.
Yeah, in I mean, it's not easy to be a woman artist today. And I can't imagine trying to be a woman artist in the 1920s. I mean, she had to leave Seattle because of the prejudice against women in the arts. But yeah, she... Whew. Well, thank you so much for taking an hour out of your day and sharing everything with
Daniel.
The listeners. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, my pleasure. Hey, everybody. I forgot to include Sarah's contact information, or you can find her on the web when we did the interview. So I just want to kind of throw that in here real quick before we close up for this week's podcast. You can find her up on the web at sarahdkingphotography.com, and that's Sarah with an H. That's also her handle up on Instagram. So if you look for Sarah D. King Photography up on Instagram, you can see her work there. And her VISM Monographs site is vismmonographs.com. So you can check her out there. I hope you take a look at her work. It's pretty amazing. And I really appreciate her taking the time out to do the interview. And don't forget, you can always find us up on the web at www.theperceptivephotographer.com, or you can find us up on iTunes and subscribe or give us a rating there. We'd really appreciate it. I hope you join us next week when we have our last interview for the month. Good luck behind the camera this week, and I'll see you next time.